In short, the configuration of life in India, as in most countries, is in crucial respects determined by Western civilization. Yet tens of millions of American students do not know this. When I tell high school and college students about it in my lectures, they profess ignorance, even indignation. The reason is that they have been getting a very different message from their professors. The Indians are being forced to live like this, they insist. It is what the British inflicted on them. Well, perhaps, but the British left India in 1947, and India became free. The Indians could easily have cast off their suits and ties and returned to their native garb. They had the option of returning to ancient tribal modes of government. The Indians could have outlawed the English language and required all education to be in Hindustani, or one of the native dialects. But the Indians did not do any of these things. They decided on their own and for their benefit to continue doing many of the things that they had learned from the British. This thought upsets many American students. The reason for their distress is that what our young people know is largely the product of multicultural education, which teaches them to despise Western civilization. One of the central premises of multiculturalism is that Western civilization is not superior to, or better than, any other civilization. To think this, in the multicultural view, is to be guilty of racism. Against this doctrine of cultural superiority, multiculturalists insist that all cultures are basically equal. Each culture is an adaptation to its own unique environment, and no culture is better or worse than, superior or inferior to, any other. A few years ago, the novelist Saul Bellow reportedly made the remark, "Show me the Proust of the Papuans, the Tolstoy of the Zulus, and I will read him." Bellow's comment was greeted with a universal cry of outrage. As one Ivy League professor put it, Bellow's statement was astoundingly racist. But why? Bellow was not suggesting that the Papuans were incapable of producing a Proust, or the Zulus a Tolstoy. He was merely saying that, as far as he knew, they hadn't. But Bellow's sin was to imply that some cultures, and specifically Western culture, might have contributed more to the dining table of civilization than others. This violated the multicultural premise of the equality of all cultures. Another example. In the early 1990s, I attended a meeting of an historical society at which academicians were virtually coming to blows over the question of whether Columbus discovered America or whether he merely encountered America. An odd subject for fisticuffs, certainly. But beneath the semantic dispute was a larger issue. You see, the notion of discovery implies a subject and an object, as in Fleming discovered penicillin. By contrast, encounter is a more neutral term that implies a meeting on a plane of equality. The historians who objected to the term discovery were trying to camouflage the fact that it was Columbus and his ships that ventured out and landed on the shores of the Americas, and not American Indians who landed on the shores of Europe. If one begins with the multicultural premise that all cultures are equal, then the world as it is makes very little sense. After all, we live in a world where, by virtually any measure of achievement or success, some cultures are advanced and others are backward. To take one measure of success that everybody seems to want, economic development, it is obvious that the West is vastly ahead of everyone else. There is simply no comparison between, say, the per capita income of Europe and America and that of the nations of sub-Saharan Africa. If sub-Saharan Africa were to sink into the ocean tomorrow, the world economy would be largely unaffected. We could use other measures of civilizational achievement, but the result would remain largely the same. The prevalence of poverty, repression, civil war, AIDS, and other horrors recently persuaded UN Secretary General Kofi Annan to term sub-Saharan Africa a cocktail of disasters. Hierarchy, not equality, appears to be the governing principle for the cultures of the world as they are now. Multiculturalists do not so much deny this as object to it on moral grounds. In their view, to rank Western civilization at the top, to give priority to the West, to establish a curriculum focused on the West, is to be guilty of Eurocentrism. The term Eurocentrism simply means placing Europe at the center of things, and it sounds like a pretty narrow and arrogant way to view the world. But of course, if we are trying to describe the world in which we live, indeed the modern world of the past few centuries, then it is entirely accurate to focus on Europe, to place Western civilization at the center. Indeed, it was the West, expanding outward, which found and conquered and defined the rest of the world. For example, Asia, Africa, and the Middle East did not exist before Westerners came up with those names and a geography that divided up the planet in that way. India was made up of an assortment of local kingdoms before it developed, through its relationship to the West, national boundaries, and eventually a sense of national identity. The Eurocentric approach seems entirely justified when you consider that Western civilization has dominated the world for nearly five centuries. Within the West, admittedly, the center of power has shifted. Inside the competing orbit of the West, the Portuguese first had the upper hand, then the Spanish, then the French, and then the English. Even so, never in the past few hundred years has the leadership position slipped out of the hands of the West. On the contrary, the West became more and more influential to the point that a century ago, part of the 20th century, nearly 85% of the real estate on the planet was under the control and supervision of Western civilization. It was the heyday of colonialism. In avidly seeking to downplay Western political, economic, military, and cultural superiority, advocates of multiculturalism emphasize that all cultures are on an equal plane and are equally worthy of study. Thus, the multicultural curriculum treats in great detail the traditional religions and customs of non-Western cultures, even though many of those customs and mores are on the way out in those cultures. This fact was comically illustrated for me recently when I was watching on television a replay of the heavyweight title fight between Muhammad Ali and George Foreman. It was held in the 1970s in the African nation of Zaire, and somewhat insensitively billed as the Rumble in the Jungle. Both Ali and Foreman study their African roots in order to win the support of the crowd and establish a psychological edge against the other. When their plane arrived, out came Ali, out came Foreman, and both were impressively regaled in traditional African outfits, headdresses, dashikis, and so on. But there to greet them on the tarmac were several hundred Africans in suits, looking a little puzzled at this clear case of multiculturalism gone awry. My point is that American multiculturalists are giving our students museumized portraits of non-Western cultures, even as those cultures have moved and continue to move rapidly in the direction of the West. Thus, American students are getting a false picture. They are not being prepared to face the world as it is, a world that is shaped and dominated by Western civilization. Why did Western civilization become so dominant in the modern era? How did this massive transformation of the world begin? This important question is rendered all the more provocative by the realization that for most of human history, other civilizations have proven far more advanced than the West, more advanced in learning, in wealth, in exploration, in inventions, and in cultural sophistication and works of the mind. We can see this clearly by taking an imaginative leap back in time to AD 1500, when the West, as we know it, was just starting to emerge. In AD 1500, there were several civilizations dotting the globe, and two of them stood out in resplendence: the civilization of China and the civilization of the Arab Islamic world. During the Ming Dynasty, the wealth, knowledge, and power of China astonished all those who came into contact with it. Chinese astronomers knew more about eclipses and heavenly orbits than anyone else at the time. The Chinese were responsible for inventions of surpassing importance: printing, gunpowder, and the compass. In the 15th century, the Chinese sent a fleet of ships, the largest and most sophisticated of their kind, to explore the shores of Africa, India, and other countries. At home, the Chinese ruling class presided over an empire distinguished by its size and cohesion. Confucian philosophy gave a kind of moral and intellectual unity to Chinese civilization. the Chinese had a merit system of government appointments when most of the world operated on traditional systems of nepotism and patronage.